I'm going to continue our Lent series on the seven signs of Jesus. These are the seven signs that the Apostle John points out as showing Jesus' divinity, that he is God. Right, I'll say that again. There was a bit of a buzz. So, welcome everyone. Hope you're enjoying the morning. I'm going to continue today our series on the seven signs of Jesus, the Lent series we're doing. These are the seven signs that the Apostle John points out as showing Jesus' divinity, that he is God. So far we've heard from Neil about Jesus turning water into wine, cleansing the temple, healing the nobleman's son, and healing the man at the pool. And today I'm going to talk about the fifth of John's signs, Jesus walking on water. So if you've got a Bible, please turn to John chapter 6, 16 to 21, or go on your phone, or just read the slide above me, if you like. I shall read from John 6, 16 to 21. When evening came, his disciples went down to the lake, where they got into a boat and set off across the lake for Capernaum. By now it was dark, and Jesus had not yet joined them. A strong wind was blowing, and the waters grew rough. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on water, and they were very frightened. Let me repeat that. They saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on water, and they were very frightened. But he said to them, "It is I, don't be afraid." Then they were willing to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. Now, three out of the four gospel writers include this miracle: Matthew, Mark, and John. And they all have slightly different details about it. For example, Matthew and Mark talk about Jesus calming a storm. And Matthew says the disciples began to worship Jesus when he got in the boat. And John is the only one who says the boat immediately reached the shore. Now, I wanted to point these out because these things are sometimes the elephant in the room. People might have read the other ones and be thinking, well, how come that bit isn't in this one? Does that mean that the Bible can't be trusted? This kind of questions. And some people do think that. Where there's inconsistencies or differences, some people say, well, that means that the whole thing's nonsense, can't be trusted. But actually, most historians and theologians, if you don't know what those are, young people, they are people who look at history and look at the Bible for a job. Most of them seem to think that this means it's more trustworthy, not less. Which might sound a bit weird, but it's because if it was all made up, then probably someone would have come along, maybe an editor or the disciples when they got together, and looked at it and thought, we need to correct these inconsistencies. This doesn't quite make sense. We need to smooth this over. Most likely, if this was all made up, the three accounts would all actually be the same, or at least they would all have the same details. But in real life, and I was listening to a policeman talk about this, if you asked three people who were at the same event a few years later to describe that event, they'll all give slightly different details. They'll all emphasize slightly different things. So to me, and to a lot of other people, these differences show that the Bible is more, not less trustworthy. And as I said, I wanted to mention that, A, because it's a bit of an elephant in the room sometimes, but also just to kind of link with what Zachary was talking about so well. How important it is to grapple with some of the arguments people make against the Bible, against the Christian faith. Now, going back to the miracle, I personally like a bit of context when I read the Bible. I like to understand, what would this have looked like? What would this have felt like? What happened before? What happened after? So to give a little bit of context, just before this miracle, Jesus had fed the 5,000. So some of you might have read that. He was preaching and people were hungry, and using just one loaf and one fish, he fed 5,000 people. And after that, he and his disciples went down the hillside, and Jesus went off to be alone. And whilst the disciples got into their boat to row across the water to Capernaum, Jesus was alone, presumably praying. And with the next slide, we've got... Oh, can we have the one before that? Slide before, that's it. Sea of Galilee, just to give you a bit of geography of where that is. So you can see up here at the top, you've got the Sea of Galilee. down the bottom, you've got Jerusalem. Around about 50 miles south of the Sea of Galilee, we find Jerusalem, which is where Jesus walks there later on in the Bible to Jerusalem, ultimately to the cross. But that's where it is. And the next slide, if we could grab that. So you can see on this slide, this is the sort of top half of the Sea of Galilee. It's not actually a sea, it's a lake. It's a very big lake, about 13 miles long and about 8 miles wide. And you can see up here on the top right, where the feeding of the 5,000 took place, roughly that would be where the disciples set off in their boat to go across the lake to Capernaum. Now, that is around about, if they didn't do it directly, which they probably didn't, it would be around about sort of 7 miles. So they'd been rowing, storm had whipped up, they'd been rowing about 4 or 5 miles, and most people, I read, would have, most fishermen, most sensible fishermen would have gone, do you know what, this is dangerous. The wind, the waves, this is not safe. I'm going to turn around. I'm going to just let the wind and the waves blow me to safety. I'm just going to rest there until the morning, till it calms down and go to where I need to be. But the disciples were so faithful, so dedicated to Jesus, they carried on rowing, despite the wind and despite the waves. And at the height of the storm and in the middle of the night, probably all exhausted and scared, they see a figure walking across the water. Now, we're going to do something a little bit unusual. I know there's been a few unusual things today. We're going to do another one. So, if you're happy to, if you're comfortable to, can I ask you to close your eyes as I describe the scene to you? And we should have some sounds coming up too. Okay, let's imagine being in a small boat with some friends. It's nighttime. The moon is covered by clouds and the wind is blowing. The boat is being rocked by the waves that are breaking against the side. You've been rowing for ages and you are knackered, absolutely exhausted. And then in the distance, one of your friends says, look, there's someone walking on the water. You all look, and yes, there is someone. But how can this be? It looks like they are on the water, not in the water. It can't be, but they're walking directly towards the boat. Is it a ghost? Is it your imagination? And then they come even closer. And suddenly you recognize them. It's your friend, Jesus. And he says in a calm, kind voice, it's me. Don't be afraid. And when you let him in the boat, the storm immediately calms down. The lake is flat. And you find yourselves amazingly at the shore. All is well. All is safe. Okay, you can open your eyes if you like. Now, I've got some questions for primary school age children. Again. How, you can shout this one out. How did you feel when you closed your eyes and imagined being in the storm at night? Anyone primary school, how did you feel when that happened, when you closed your eyes? Oh, got one at the back. No hope. Yeah, I can imagine that. Yeah, exhausted, scared, no hope. Absolutely. All right, next one. Thank you, by the way. How did you feel when you had your eyes closed and you imagined seeing someone walking on the water? Anybody? Yes, Oscar. Shocked, absolutely. I definitely would have felt shocked. Good answer. Yeah. Amazed, yes. Scared and creepy. Yeah, exactly. The disciples were terrified. So yes. These are great answers, everyone. All right, final one. How did you feel when you realized it was your friend coming towards you? Shocked? Yeah. Pretty happy, absolutely. Yeah, Oscar. Relieved, definitely relieved. These are great answers, and I think all of them pretty much sum up how the disciples would have felt. and how most of us would have felt. And did you notice, by the way, that Jesus came to them? They didn't have to seek him out. He came to them, and he comes to us, actually. The Bible says that God is knocking at our doors, and we just have to open the door to let him into our lives and into our hearts. That's an aside. I could go into all of that, but just wanted to mention that. Now, in Matthew's account of this miracle, it says that when Jesus came to them, the disciples were so amazed, so comforted, and so in awe that they started worshipping him and saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." So maybe it was this miracle. Maybe it was seeing Jesus defying the laws of nature to walk on the water, to walk across the stormy sea that caused them to worship. I think that would be enough for me to cry out and worship, personally, to see that level of miracle, to see, to be that amazed. But maybe also, I wonder if it was his words. "It is I, don't be afraid." Now those words might sound relatively normal and comforting, but actually most Bibles don't translate those words quite with the power I think they're originally written. What he actually says is, "I am, don't be afraid." Now this is a phrase that Jesus did use from time to time in different circumstances. But sometimes it seems that he says, "I am," to signify something else. By using these words, Jesus seems to be connecting himself with what God says to Moses in the burning bush. Way back in Exodus, close to the start of the Bible, God has appeared to Moses in a burning bush and told him to go and set the slaves, the Israelites, free. But then Moses understandably says, "Okay, but who shall I say has sent me?" And God simply says, "I am who I am. Tell them I am, has sent me to you." Now it looks like Jesus is saying something similar here. The disciples are terrified by this figure walking towards them on the water, over the wind and the waves, and he simply says, "I am. Do not be afraid." I think he's doing more than just saying, comforting, "Don't be afraid." It looks like what he's really saying is, "Don't be afraid, it's me, Jesus, God." There's something about this miracle, something about what Jesus did and what he said that took the disciples' faith to a new level. So much so that they realized how glorious Jesus is, how powerful, how holy. Maybe for the first time that Jesus really is the Son of God. John is using this miracle as one of his proofs that Jesus is God, and Matthew tells us that those in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Now, lots of us in this room will have had specific moments when we've realized God's existence, his holiness and his love for us. Some of us will have had snapshot moments, and others maybe would have had a slower realization, maybe through some of the conversations similar to what Zach mentioned. You know, people realize the truth of God's love differently and at different rates, but my hope is that anyone in this room who's been walking with Jesus for a while, who's allowed Jesus into their heart, will have had moments they can't help but worship him. Like for me, I remember the very first one. I was sat on a train. Apologies if I've told you this one before. I tend to repeat myself sometimes. I was sat on a train. Before I was doing this, I was an accountant. I was revising for a very fascinating tax exam. I think I've been up most of the night. And I was going on train from Brighton to Crawley for the exam. And I was absolutely knackered. And I knew that I had to reread this one chapter to try and drill this tax law into my head. And it just wasn't going in. I was too tired. And I wasn't a Christian at the time. And I just said this prayer in my head. I said, "God, if you exist, can you just wake me up, please?" And honestly, in that moment, no one would have seen anything. But it's like I'd had 25 Red Bulls. I just went, "Whoa." And for me, I knew something incredible had happened, a miracle had happened, something I couldn't have manufactured or just conjured up. So that was the very first, and then shortly after that, I started an Alpha course, and then something called Freedom in Christ, which is almost like a beta, kind of an after Alpha course. And through that, I kind of realized my own sin, I realized God's love for us, his holiness, and it was a sort of slow burn until finally I was in a church. And we were in worship, and I found myself weeping, overwhelmed by God's holiness. It had hit me. And these two moments are really important to me in my life as moments of realizing God's existence and realizing his holiness. And now I have these moments in different places. Often when I'm out in nature, walking on Wimbledon Common or down by the sea or the river. Or right now, walking around Putney and just seeing the amazing cherry blossom in the trees. All that time of barrenness and emptiness, pent-up energy suddenly exploding in pinks and whites and reds. The miracle of new life. I love Psalm 104. How many, how manifold are your works, Lord. In wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. There is the sea, vast and spacious, teeming with creatures beyond number. And similarly, when I see a newborn baby, I kind of melt. I just can't help but be stunned by the innocence, by the beauty, by the intricacy and the perfection of a brand new human being. Where there was nothing, there is now something so special. The beauty of new life, it's amazing. And to me, it shouts out, it cries out God's glory. And what about reading the Bible? I love that. I love seeing the big picture of God's love for us. Never forsaking us, time and time again, forgiving his people, forgiving the Israelites, forgiving us, until finally Jesus comes and gives his very life for us, his death and resurrection, giving us hope and freedom with his kingdom unfolding all around us. For me, these are just a few of the things that make me want to fall on my knees and worship at the majesty, kindness, and beauty and grace of God. But what about you? Picking up on Grace's question, what makes you fall on your knees in worship? Maybe it's music. Maybe it's getting caught up in God's presence while listening to or singing worship songs. Just like now, with like, how good with this worship band? So good. Yes. Yeah. Getting caught up in that place of worship, knowing the magnitude and the majesty of God's love. For others in the room, maybe you're a bit like me. Maybe you get overwhelmed with God's love whilst reading the Bible or walking in nature. Maybe looking at the ocean. And for yet others, it might be prayer or silence or serving the poor or fighting injustice. All of us can find God in any of these, maybe all of them. But most of us have got one or two where we most easily connect with God's presence and fall on our knees. But I think there's also one other way that God can get all of us, including many who don't yet have a faith, who don't yet know Jesus. I think there's one other way he can get us to fall on our knees in worship, in awe and wonder, and that's when we see a miracle, when we encounter a miracle for ourselves. In this story, we saw the disciples encounter Jesus walking on the water. They saw a miracle they just could not explain. They saw him calming the storm and comforting them with his words, and they couldn't help but declare him to be the Son of God. So this week, again, picking up on what Grace was saying, can I encourage you to do two things? Firstly, to search out opportunities to do whatever it is that helps you want to fall on your knees in worship. And the second is to take a bit of time to write down any miracles you've encountered, experienced in your life, to reinforce your faith for them now, and then to pray for miracles in your life and the lives of those who you love and those you know. Whether that's healings, changing circumstances, maybe people desperately need money, whatever that miracle is, can I encourage you to pray for that this week? Put it before God, whatever it is. So two things. Whatever it is that makes you most naturally want to worship God, seek that out. And secondly, write down miracles from your past and pray for new ones. Because we have an incredible, beautiful, majestic, awe-inspiring Father in heaven who loves you and me so much that he gave his very life for us. Now, in a moment, we're going